Hi, this is Morgan Michael welcoming you to Kindsight 101, the podcast, where you'll hear from world-renowned educational leaders about the mobilizing power of kindness. I believe that we all have an innate need to be seen, heard, and understood. When we dedicate ourselves to kindness, the ripple effects in our schools can be life-changing. Through this podcast, I want to challenge you to question your assumptions, amplify your insight, and embrace a willingness to go beyond the status quo in education. Together, let's learn how to make a big impact, one small act at a time. Have you ever wondered how kind your school is? Well, today's guest invented the research-backed metric that every school should employ to measure the kindness of their culture. In our conversation, we explore three different types of kindness and ways to empower our students to practice daily kindnesses. We also talk about the surprising relationship between resiliency and kindness. Enjoy the episode. Dr. John Tyler Binfett is an assistant professor at the University of British Columbia in Canada. He focuses on two areas of research: conceptualizations of kindness in school and the effects of animal-assisted therapy on students' well-being. His area of expertise include perceptions of school kindness, social and emotional learning, homesickness, stress reduction in university students, and animal-assisted therapy, particularly canine. He has also developed the unique BARK, BARK Dog Therapy Program. For more information, visit bark.sitesolt.ubc.ca or my website, smallactbigimpact.com, and search for episode 33. Thanks so much for listening. I want to thank you for the wonderful reviews that you've left for this podcast on iTunes. Your reviews make a big difference in helping other educators find this show. If you think that I'm doing good work here and you'd like others to get inspired and join our 21-day kindness challenge and movement, I'd love it if you would take a minute, head over to iTunes, and leave a review. Thank you so much. You developed a metric to measure the perceptions of kindness in schools. Your study and key findings about, I think it was 1,753 students across 78 different classrooms. Most of the research to date has been focused on the things that we do as educators to deter negative behaviors, bullying, with relatively little attention given to those factors that foster student, you know, positive human qualities, such as the compassion and kindness in schools. So there has been a bit of focus on that lately in terms of social emotional learning skills. Can you speak about the school kindness scale and how you developed it and why?
Sure. So the school kindness scale is co-authored with Kim Schonert-Reichel from UBC Vancouver and Anne Gatterman. And I looked at the literature and I saw there was just it really started with a graduate student of mine who did an analysis. We looked at all the publications from 2004 to 2014 that addressed bullying or kindness. And we found that for every single article on kindness, there were 28 articles on bullying. And I thought, I work with teacher education students, and I thought, well, as knowledge consumers, it's just far too easy for them to get information on bullying. And I wanted more information on kindness, and I really saw that there was a dearth or a lack of research and information or scholarly writing on kindness. So that was kind of the background of that. And then I dug in, and I was sort of trained in psychometrics back in my early days, and I thought, well, I like scale development. And so I looked, and lo and behold, in 1998, an Italian researcher by the name Anna Communion had developed a scale of, I think, 60 items, something like that. And it was normed on kids 13 to all the way up to adults who are 60. But it wasn't specific to school. And I thought, okay, well, there's a need here to find out what kids think about their schools within a kind framework. So that was the whole sort of background of that. And it really arose from this distortion of all this information on bullying and very, very little on kindness.
Interesting. And it seems as though there's a real focus right now on that positive psychology piece. Coming up with that kindness scale must have been challenging at times, because like kindness and some of the other types of scales that people like Sonia Lubomirsky has come up with, these are skills that are really tricky to pinpoint in terms of metrics. So really it all comes down to our perceptions and our narratives that we tell ourselves about what's happening around us. Can you speak a little bit to that specifically as it relates to, you know, how we can reframe our own experiences, negative or positive, and then help students to do the same?
Yeah, well, As I said, I work in teacher education. I tell my young teachers, I tell them, you arrive every day to the classroom with, you know, a certain quantity of energy, and it's entirely up to us to determine which direction that energy goes. And we have the option. We could spend a lot of energy in terms of corrective practices to, you know, punish students or to focus on antisocial behavior and try to deter that. Or we could take that energy and we could focus on more positive dimensions of the classroom and school experience. And that's what I really encourage my student teachers to do. And also I try to practice that. I really embrace positive psychology and then the derivative field, positive education. And that really looks at the strengths and attributes of students, what they're doing well and what we're able to build and help flourish, rather than the deficits, what they're not doing well and what they need to fix or repair. So positive psychology is really, really important. And I think it parallels social emotional learning quite nicely. And there are, you know, national and international conferences uniquely on positive psychology and positive education. So this is a field of study for teachers and parents even, and for students themselves to embrace if they're curious to focus on what is working and what has potential to work well for them.
That's wonderful. And I really agree. I think it's my own experience as an educator. I've noticed that students just flourish if they can see themselves in a positive way, if they can reframe themselves through the way that you see them. And if you're able to connect with them on a real fundamental level, that what they're able to produce or even do in terms of how they interact with others and even the academic aspect really has a lot to do with how they see themselves. And that is fundamentally what a teacher is really responsible for, is changing that mindset. So I want to talk a little bit about resiliency and how teachers can support students to become more resilient in the face of failure, perceived failure, or difficulties, so that they don't sort of succumb to a more negative perhaps perspective of themselves based on the past or even their home experiences. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Well, you know, as an illustration, I was trained as a psychologist, and a lot of people were, and teachers too, were trained to sort of wait for kids to start floundering, right? So they would, you know, say, hey, I'm sinking, it's not going well, and then sweep in with all these wonderful strategies. And people continue to do that, but perhaps less so. And the metaphor that we sort of use to illustrate is that instead of sort of throwing the life raft or life vest for kids, we really try to inflate their life vest prior so that they're resilient in the face of adversity. Because we all know it's the sort of the one constant is that we will have struggles, and we want kids to be equipped to deal with whatever the struggles are because they have strong social emotional learning competencies. So it's a philosophy in many ways that you don't want to wait for the kids to sink and then sweep in. You want to do proactive, resilient building strategies that equip the kids to really handle life's sort of knocks and sort of hurdles in a way that moves them forward and doesn't debilitate them. So I think that's every parent and educator's job, is to be a cheerleader for kids in many ways. And people are really talking about this idea of having kids become more self-reliant or self-regulated and not leaning too heavily on the adults around them, but rather sort of negotiating their pathways and themselves on their own. So there's a lot here at play, but I think teachers and parents are in unique positions to really be those cheerleaders for kids.
Absolutely. And when you are speaking to new teachers, what are some of the strategies for resilient, you know, building resiliency? Are there any sort of actionable, you know, ideas that we can keep in the back of our heads as we approach a new classroom or, you know, as we're teaching these students with so many different backgrounds? Are there any things that you think you could tell a teacher to keep in the back of their heads in order to do so in a more effective way?
Well, I think clearly from the research, we know that children who are strong in their social emotional competencies, so their ability to perspective take, their ability to delay gratification, to understand others' views, to understand their own emotions, to regulate their emotions, to make wise decisions, all this combination of skills and that very frankly, many adults continue to work on and struggle with,
Sure.
that if we get kids in classrooms learning that, taught by teachers who are equipped themselves with strong social and emotional literacy skills, then we set them up for strong, I would say, sort of reactions or strong direction in the face of adversity. I would tell young teachers, especially, to just invest in learning about social emotional learning themselves, learn about their own skills, and then learn different ways, whether it's through a prepackaged program or more of a freelance approach to building social skills in kids or social emotional competencies. That really, across the literature, we know that that serves kids best.
Sure. So without getting too much into the neuroscience of kindness, I'd like to talk and maybe touch a little bit on how you believe that kindness may or may not have an impact on reducing some of the stressors and anxieties and depression even that some of our youth are experiencing these days. And even the increase in levels of, anxiety and depression has been surprising lately. And, I'm just curious to know what your impression of sort of building these kindness skills, what that might do for those levels of anxiety and depression.
Well, what we know is that being intentionally kind or practicing kindness is a happiness enhancing strategy, right?
Right.
And so we know that it'll boost well-being. And the reason for that is largely because it increases interpersonal connections. And so it requires a lot of perspective taking. When we have, I worked with 300 eighth graders this morning and coached them through this process of identifying who within their community is deserving of kindness. And so they perspective take and they put themselves in the shoes of others. And then they have to craft and they have to put energy into determining what kind of kindness is appropriate for that person. There's a variety of different kinds of different ways to be kind. And so we'll have discussions around that. But I think in terms of anxiety, depression, sort of negative affect in general, we'll describe that I would describe kindness as the antidote to that. And so I encourage kids to promote their own mental health and well-being by being intentionally kind, planning kindness for deserving others. And the key from the literature is what we know from over interviews with 3,000 students now at UBC Okanagan is that when you ask young people to be kind, they tend to be kind, upwards of 80% to people they already know. So they're kind to individuals with whom they have existing relationships. And that's problematic. It's problematic for kids who are socially isolated, kids who are low in affect and maybe not plugged into a social system. Because when teachers orchestrate kind initiatives in a school, we can guarantee that there are going to be kids who are not caught up in receiving that kindness. So in some ways, it actually serves to alienate them even further. So I would say, recapping that kindness is really a well-being boosting strategy to move kids beyond their current state, especially if they're ruminating and sort of rewinding the tape over and over and over about some sort of negative event that went on. Kindness can kind of push them beyond.
Absolutely. And I think that's such an important point is that as teachers and educators that we're mindful of those students who may not jump on board, and then that widening gap between those who feel connected and as though they belong to the group and then the ones who don't, and how that can affect all sorts of different aspects of their state. So I appreciate you mentioning that. I think sometimes there's this concept even of feeling incredibly lonely and disconnected from one another within being within the group and experiencing that loneliness even around other people. So I think that's an important point. Why do you think it's important to develop metrics by which to measure these social emotional learning skills or states like kindness and empathy and happiness within our classrooms?
Well, I mean, the one sort of obvious response to that is that it allows you to establish baseline measures that will then subsequently serve to demonstrate growth over time. So you really, really only want to be implementing things that actually positively impact kids. And the one way to do that is to have psychometric scales that that are geared towards students themselves to capture their perception versus, you know, uniquely relying on adults to say, well, this is how I interpret your experience. So I think having good scales or measurement items are critical to sort of enhancing or safeguarding good practices in terms of implementation of programs and ways to interact with kids or create learning environments that fuel their development and move them forward. So I think we'll see perhaps more and more in terms of measurement and evaluation within the fields of social emotional learning and then in particular kindness.
Sure. So within some of your work, you've identified the difference between climate, you know, school climate and culture. And you've also identified five general areas to build culture, and I'll just name them. So the safety, relationships, teaching and learning, institutional environment, and then finally the school improvement. So how can teachers and educational leaders strive to improve and sustain all of these different areas? And what is the difference between climate and culture at schools?
Well, I think, you know, I tell the young teachers with whom I work, I tell them this has to be a priority within the classroom. It's not just the core academic subject areas, but I get them to really sort of address and treat climate building as a bit of its own entity. It certainly feeds the delivery of instruction across different curricula, but in and of itself, I really, really encourage teachers to take the time to establish a positive climate. And I'm a little bit loath to sort of say there's a recipe for it or, you know, this is uniquely how to do it, because I think it really depends on the personality of the teacher or parent. It really depends on the group of kids with whom you're working. I think it depends on the ecological environment, where they're working, what kind of space they're in. So there's a lot of different things, but you was one of the five pillars is the sort of this relationship-driven teaching. And that really, I would say, is one of the key ones, that teachers take the time to know their children and establish some kind of connection that is unique between them, that feels valuable for kids, that kids really feel connected to teachers. And then in turn, what we see is when kids feel connected to their teachers, there's this positive rapport, they behave differently. They engage in class differently. They are unafraid to ask questions. They take intellectual risks. So these are all things that are serve student learning and growth and development well. And so we want teachers focusing on that. Your second question is about class climate and culture. Well, I think, you know, I'm not a sociologist or anthropologist, but we know that class climate is unique to a setting and that it certainly can be constructed through efforts made to build community, to establish connections among individuals, and to create safety, the perception certainly of safety by all participants there. So I really see that as kind of a no-brainer for teachers to place emphasis on that and to really strive to create a positive classroom climate and one that really will serve all learning throughout the school year.
I agree. And I think it even, you can extrapolate that to the leader educator as well in terms of, you know, making sure that that climate reflects these norms and a lot of our values that we believe in terms of kindness and empathy and some of the other SEL skills. So I want to talk a little bit about that. So sometimes the overt messages and lessons students are receiving as it relates to kindness doesn't always reflect in terms of the school culture or the climate itself. So can you speak to the concept of this hidden curriculum in schools and that sometimes these overt lessons that we're getting don't always reflect within that climate?
Well, kids are smart and they can smell insincerity a mile away. So I'm very sensitive to this because it really is sort of, we want teachers walking the talk. And so we want, for example, educators who themselves are kind, who practice kindness interpersonally with their colleagues, who work to create a kind school climate with parents and other stakeholders. And so kids will pick up on these nuanced tensions And so you can't fool them around that. And so that hidden curriculum is this idea of really sort of saying one thing or purporting one thing, maybe a school mission statement, you know, state something, but yet it's not enacted in the day-to-day lives and interactions with kids. And so oftentimes we'll see that with discipline, right? Yeah. And it could be they'll say students have a voice and students are encouraged to express their opinions and all this kind of stuff. But yet when there's an infraction, there's just one pathway, which is, you know, typically exclusion from the school community.
Right.
And that in and of itself is can be problematic because the kids who are excluded are essentially the ones who need access to the adult social emotional learning agents. And so when you remove them there, it doesn't make sense to me to do that. But and I understand there's safety issues at times, but really I think we're just talking about this idea of creating climates that feed everybody, including the adults in there. And that hidden curriculum is one where it just keeps everybody honest. And I think you asked earlier about this idea of psychometrics and scales and whatnot. And teachers really and educators need different ways to access what kids are thinking and what their experience is like.
Yes.
Because oftentimes you face the wrong direction at the front of a class and you're not entirely sure of what the experience is from the student's perspective.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's such an important point really to tune into the reflections of students and then to really actually, like you said, walk the talk and have the perspective taking ourselves and the ability to offer them that space and place to share how they're feeling and what their experiences are and use that to inform our own practice so that they are able to learn in the most effective way. So speaking about that a little bit and just branching out into the future a little bit, as we know, with the advent of technology and AI and all sorts of things on the horizon that really are fundamentally going to change life as we know it in the next 5, 10, even next year, what do you think are the essential skills that we need to be teaching students for the future in school?
I think, well, some people might argue, have skills that can't be done by a robot, right?
So, mm-hmm.
You can find employment. I think this is a really good question. And I think a lot of parents grapple with this. I mean, the stereotype is the adolescent boy who's in the basement gaming and doesn't see sunlight or have any contact with anyone else, right? So people are concerned about this. I heard a story recently of folks who were working, adults who were working in software and app stations, and one fellow didn't realize that the guy sitting next to him for 6 months had a British accent. And I thought, wow, we've kind of compartmentalized our skill sets. But, you know, what I can tell you is this. We know that, you know, a synonym in the business world for social emotional competencies or skills are called soft skills.
Mm.
And these are these interpersonal skills, an ability to relate to others, collaborate with others, communicate clearly, express your emotions in an appropriate place, in a way in the workplace. And what we know is that people are terminated from their jobs, they lose their jobs predominantly for a lack of soft skills, not for a lack of technical competence. And so it's causing trouble for folks who are highly trained, but yet don't have the skills to function in a cooperative setting. So that is an issue for folks. And I would say, really, we're going to see more and more young adults who are leaving school under-equipped to survive in the workplace. And it's going to be based on those soft skills because there's been an overemphasis on maybe technical proficiency.
I would agree. And I think that's where the kindness piece and the social-emotional learning skills are so fundamental. And also the metacognition around it, that awareness that here's why we're learning these things or here's why we're engaging in this, you know, STEM activity. It's really about building that grit and the resiliency and just those quote-unquote soft skills as well. So thank you for speaking to that. Can you speak a little bit about the BARC program and how animals can contribute to positive school cultures and even the retention of learning in students? And I just think this is such a fascinating research point.
Yeah, I run a program called Building Academic Retention Through Canines, or the BARC program. We're starting year 7 soon, and we have 60 therapy dogs who work on campus with us, and we do a variety of different interventions and programs in the community as well as on campus. And we are primarily a stress reduction program. So these are kids who are floundering, maybe finding their coursework too complicated to master or handle, or overwhelmed by the amount of work they have to do, or feeling socially isolated and homesick. And so we run different interventions to get these kids plugged in. And the dogs do the bulk of the work. The handlers who oversee the interactions are quite skilled and trained, but the dogs are able to often bridge connections that humans can't quite bridge. And so that's been a very rewarding aspect of my work and research. And we've found now as little as 20 minutes interactions with dogs can significantly reduce stress and change the perception of, to the extent that kids feel they belong within the school community. So I think this is also an area that public schools are really curious about. And we're seeing some service dogs in school, especially for kids on the spectrum, we're seeing increase in service dogs.
Yes.
But schools are curious about the effects of therapy dogs in terms of bridging kids to other kids and maybe changing behavior. And we see some reading dog programs that have wonderful success in having the kids read to therapy dogs, and they find that very non-threatening. And we see reluctant readers just flourish. So there's a lot of wonderful benefits or outcomes that come from structured programs that are based or grounded in canine therapy.
And what do you attribute that success to? Because I mean, that's just incredible. And it's such an interesting way of integrating animals within our school systems and really changing the face of education to include animals. I love it. And I have seen service dogs within the community and of course in schools to support children on the spectrum. So what would you attribute that success to?
Well, I think it sort of harkens to your earlier question about technology. And what we see is that when students immerse themselves fully in technology, they isolate themselves from nature. And there is a certain hunger to just get connected to animals and nature. And so when you provide that opportunity at a university campus, an environment where they perhaps don't expect that, it has even more profound impact on the students. So I think we live in busy sort of worlds and very technology driven, and the animals provide this refreshing reminder to just be present, to present your true self, and to interact in an earnest way to boost your well-being. So we've had wonderful success at UBC Okanagan around that in the BARC program, and we've recently had BARC dogs in the local RCMP detachment to reduce constable stress and saw significant reductions from pre- to post-test visits in the constables there. So that's exciting too.
That is so interesting. I'm really excited to hear more about that and to learn more about that in the next little while. I want to talk a little bit, just before we move on to the last portion of our interview, I want to talk a little bit about the importance of self-care in kindness and what your take is on that in terms of filling our own cups before we're able to help other people or sort of engage in kind acts.
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because I think some of us would argue that by focusing on others, you serve to fill your own cup, right? So some might see it as, well, fill your own, needs first and then extend to others. But my position is largely, especially with kids who may be adolescents, who may be a bit self-focused, and I want them thinking in a larger, a broader spectrum of those around them, especially those who might need care and concern or kindness, the literature certainly speaks to this, and this is this notion of the helper's high, that there are bidirectional benefits to being kind, that when we are kind to others, we often focus on the recipient, but in the end, it is the individual, the initiator of kindness, who reaps the bulk of the well-being from being kind. And so that's what we really encourage with young people, certainly young people who are low in their affect and feeling disconnected and a bit hopeless about things. And I encourage them to do structured intentional kindness with the help of an adult to get them on track. And that's a way of really, I think, feeding, building community, and then ensuring there's a certain sort of well-being component within the individual. I'll share with you, and shared with the 300 eighth graders this morning, when I asked in a study of 400 adolescents this last spring, I asked ninth graders to plan acts of kindness. And one of them said, you know, listed things like sweep the garage, or, you know, erase the board for my teacher to make life easier for her, things like this. And then at the end, he wrote, take a minute to hate myself less and realize that I'm okay the way I am. And that was a wonderful, poignant reminder for everybody to just be gentle with ourselves, right? And I think your question really is speaking to this idea that we can be so other-focused that we do neglect ourselves, and then that puts a compromised position. But largely the kids that I deal with, we would want them to be focused on others as a way of boosting their own sense of who they are within the school community.
Sure. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. But I appreciate you touching on that, because I think that's a fundamental sort of balance point for sure. So now I'd like to ask you a few questions, and I hope that you're able to answer them in sort of a phrase or a couple words or less. So could you define what kindness means to you?
I can, because I spent a lot of time asking the definition of kindness. So kindness is really is a social or emotional act of support to maintain relationships with those around us. And that's my understanding of what kindness is.
Okay, thank you. What book or books have you gifted most often to people, maybe specifically teachers or students?
Well, you laugh at that. Mostly to my students, I give the APA manual, the American Psychological Association manual, and that's meant that's not the most well-received, but it's a practical gift. I think the handbook, 2015 Handbook of Social-Emotional Learning, is just a wonderful, rich resource for parents and educators who are curious about science-driven findings around how to boost social-emotional learning. So that's an important one there. And then, of course, I work in canine therapy and so have a few in that area as well. But that those are the APA manual for students and then the social-emotional learning handbook.
Love that. That's awesome. What one skill or superpower does a teacher need to lead with in order to be effective?
I would say patience. It's an internal. I would just say the best teachers are ones who take deep breaths and are not reactionary, and who are calm in the moment and perspective taken. Imagine what would drive these little people to behave in a way that maybe pushes others away. And so I always tell teachers that, you know, the kids who push us away the most fervently are the ones who need us the most. So sure. I would say patience for the adult caregivers.
That's great. Now, sometimes people have answered in the same way, but it might be different for you. So what one skill or superpower does a principal need to lead with in order to be effective?
I would say a principal needs, intellectual grounding, that they need to keep up with current findings in the field that will inform practice. And I respect the principals and administrators most who are active in professional development and who are strong readers of good science in education that informs practice. And that, I think, is key.
I agree. I think that's very important. And the final question, what message or quote would you print on one of those quote cups that are sold in big bookstores that would be read by millions?
Yeah. the first one that comes to mind is, don't be afraid to be who you are. And that to me is just, I think this journey that we're on is to be ourselves and to not be afraid, because I think there's a lot of pressure with young people, especially, to be anybody but themselves. And the real rich journey in life is to just accept that we are who we are, with flaws and with lots of potential for goodness and growth. And that, I would say, just don't be afraid to be who you are.
I think that's a wonderful way to end our conversation. So I'll thank you very much for taking the time out of your very busy schedule to have this interview with me. And I very much look forward to all of the future research that you share with us.
Oh, I appreciate being a part of this and enjoyed the questions and enjoyed this positive focus on what we can sort of help cultivate in schools and create for kids. Thank you.
This has been another episode of Kindsight 101, the podcast. For links to resources mentioned in this episode, visit smallactbigimpact.com and click on our podcast and choose this episode number. Now, I'd love to give my audience a heads up about my new book, which will provide ideas, actionable strategies, and inquiry-based approaches to creating a kinder classroom through serving the community. Subscribe to my blog for more information. Now, I would love to hear from you. What's the biggest insight that you gained from this conversation? Head over to our website, smallactbigimpact.com, leave a comment on our podcast page, or tag and connect with us on social media with the hashtag #SmallActBigImpact to share your inspiring story of kindness. Can't wait to hear from you.